This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 31st of October, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcasted right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, we find out how Afghanistan is having to work with both the local Taliban and outside agencies to overcome the damage caused by this week's destructive earthquake.
They've many times in the past couple years made statements that they welcome relief workers as long as they're what they call legitimate relief workers. What they don't want to see are development workers who are really paid for and financed and organized by embassies.
We'll also hear why Brand Bond has been so successful over the years and why the new James Bond film Spectre is a spectacle of product placement, not just the title character's tales of derring do.
Bond is a very, very good brand. And it always was about the best, whether it was Dom Perignon or Omega or Aston Martin or whatever.
And we'll get the inside story on a new book about Silvio Berlusconi, Bunga Bunga Parties and All, from the book's author. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour, right here on The Recap with me, Daniel Giacopelli. We start today with a highlight from Monday's edition of the Monocle Daily, when Dominic Reynolds and Emma Nelson were joined by Declan McGarvey, Buenos Aires correspondent for France 24, for analysis of Argentina's presidential election. It was a close-run thing in which politician Daniel Scioli, the anointed successor to the outgoing Cristina de Kirchner, had just managed not to sweep to victory. Instead, Mr. Scioli will face his rival, the former mayor of Buenos Aires, Mauricio Macri, in a runoff next month. Here's Declan.
This was a huge surprise. Absolutely no one had expected this. The opinion polls had given Scioli, predicted a Scioli victory of 10 percentage points or more, which would have been a decisive victory and which would have this morning seen Daniel Scioli named president-elect of Argentina. Exit polls as well yesterday were showing this. And then everything changed late last night to the great joy of many in Argentina. It seems that Argentinians have voted for change and have given a resounding no more to 12 years of Kirchner rule, with the main opposition candidate, Mauricio Macri, running neck and neck with Daniel Scioli, the ruling party candidate, and at one point leading him as well. It seems the message is clear. Argentinians want to embrace a new era with a new direction.
It's pretty extraordinary to have such a drastic swing away from predictions, isn't it? Do we know exactly why the pollsters got it so wrong? Even the exit pollsters, that's very rare, isn't it?
Yes, it is indeed. And people are still trying to work out exactly what happened here. And no doubt Daniel Scioli, more than anyone else, is trying to work out exactly what happened. There is perhaps a sense that when people actually enter the ballot box, when they're free of having to speak to anyone else about their political leanings, which can be a very sensitive topic in Argentina as politics is inherently unstable and volatile, that they then felt free to do what they really wanted to do. And perhaps at that moment, they really decided to vote with their conscience. There was clearly an upswelling of feeling here that enough was enough after 12 years of Kirchner rule, which has deeply divided this nation and has also brought deep economic problems to Argentina. It appears that this election yesterday was something of an obituary for 12 years of Kirchner rule in Argentina.
Declan McGarvey there, Buenos Aires correspondent for France 24, speaking to Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds on Monday's Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Next, we head to Russia and Wednesday's edition of The Briefing. One might imagine that a country as large as Russia would have a slew of local film talent keeping the local audiences entertained. But the top 10 box office hits in the country currently suggest otherwise. For the first time since 2003, no domestically produced films have made it into the top 10, with places being occupied by U.S. blockbusters instead, such as The Martian. Peter Hobson, business editor of the Moscow Times, joined Steve Bloomfield on the line from Moscow to tell us why Russian films are giving up space.
I think the key reason why they're not doing so well is money. The Russian film industry simply doesn't have the same financial firepower that the U.S. film industry does. And in this highly technologically advanced blockbuster age that we're in now, that means that they just can't really compete at all. The sort of Russia does produce some very good films, but they're all, you know, many of them are really art housey, and they're never going to get a really wide audience in the first place. And so, yeah, it means that the Americans, they absolutely dominate and have done for 20 years.
There's obviously a politics angle to this as well. When I think of, you know, the Russian films that have done well outside of Russia recently, they've been films that have been quite critical of the government. Leviathan, for example, did extremely well in the UK and the US as well. Have films like that struggled to find a market inside Russia?
Well, Leviathan was an interesting one because it did do very, very well indeed, but it was controversial in Russia because it actually got subsidies from the government, from the culture ministry. And then when the film turned out to be, in many people's eyes, very bleak about Russia, even anti-Russian in its outlook, that caused a bit of an outcry. And the culture minister actually said specifically that we don't want to fund films like this. We will not fund films like this in the future. And when finally the film was released in Russia, it was released only on, you know, in certain cinemas and quite late. And so, yeah, there wasn't an opportunity for many Russians to go and see it.
The Moscow Times' Peter Hobson there talking to Steve Bloomfield in a highlight from Wednesday's edition of The Briefing. And remember, you can listen again to all of our programs via iTunes and the Monocle website. Time now to tune into Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily. A day earlier, an earthquake in Afghanistan and Pakistan had measured 7.5 on the Richter scale and killed at least 385 people and injuring some 2,000 more, mostly in Pakistan. Much of the region is controlled by the Taliban, not known for their collaborative nature. But on Tuesday, the group had signaled a readiness to cooperate with outside organizations in order to bring much-needed aid to those affected. But how does an operation like that work in practice? Well, Rod Nordland, Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times, explained it to Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson.
Well, it sounds like the epicenter is fairly close to a district called Wardush in Badakhshan province. Wardush has been Taliban-controlled for a couple of years now, on and off, but mostly on. Just getting to Wardush would take a two-day journey from the capital of that province, plus it would be extremely unsafe to do it. I don't think many aid groups would even consider going to Wardush, even with assurances from the Taliban.
What about those assurances then? We've had this statement talking about good-willed countrymen and charitable organisations being encouraged not to hold back. How far do you think that will go? Should Western NGOs end up holding back, for example?
I don't think any Western NGO will send Westerners in, but I think they might send their local staff in. There have been, the Taliban have made promises like this in the past, and they have been good to their word in many places. The problem is knowing just which Taliban you're dealing with. And there are other groups as well, rivals who've fallen out with the Taliban. Even in some parts of the earthquake hit area, groups of at least wannabe ISIS elements. And those, you know, they could not be trusted to keep those promises.
In dealing with the Taliban, that is one of the problems, as you correctly point out. I think it often gets forgotten that it is far from a monolithic organization. How do NGOs working in Afghanistan, or I guess how good have they got, because a lot of them have been there for a long time, how good have they got at making that, or judging that balance between trying to help the people they want to help, but trying to keep their own people safe?
They've gotten very good at it. And I think until the last couple of years, they had a very good record of not losing very many of their people. But since 2014, Afghanistan's been the most dangerous place in the world to be an aid worker. And even just a couple of weeks ago, an aid worker was killed in Kandahar, for instance. There have been a couple others killed recently as well in Taliban areas or Taliban-controlled areas.
I mean, when does it all stop, I suppose. I mean, if a horrible incident like this ends up opening lines of communication or sort of warming up otherwise fairly icy relationships, at what point do those sort of ice up again, if you see what I mean? When is it done?
I think that is a good point. There's a possibility it could be a real kind of confidence building thing between the government and the Taliban. It kind of lasts until it falls apart. And, you know, if there's another incident where aid workers are attacked, I think it falls apart. They have a fair amount of credibility in the north now. I mean, they certainly, when they took over Kunduz, they didn't kill any civilians that we know of, except in the fighting, in the crossfire of the fighting going in. They certainly didn't bomb any hospitals like the Americans did. And so they have that to build upon.
I mean, to what extent as well the Taliban, for all that they're not a monolith, but in a situation like this when they're looking for help from the outside world, how worried are they about how this looks, I guess, from what you might call a presentation point of view? I mean, I ask because I can remember having conversations with NGOs in Kabul going back to the late 90s, and they said that of the many reasons that the Taliban resented them, a lot of it was to do with the fact that they were providing things which the Taliban couldn't, that they demonstrably had expertise bought from the West, which the Taliban did not have. In an emergency like this, would that be a concern to the Taliban, that they may appear weak and reliant on foreigners?
No, I think they long ago moved past that attitude that aid workers were bad. And they've many times in the past couple of years made statements that they welcome relief workers as long as they're what they call legitimate relief workers. What they don't want to see are development workers who are really paid for and financed and organized by embassies and very closely aligned with the government. But independent ones, they've had a pretty good record of treating them decently. And what's important to them here is not so much the issue of saving people's lives in their territory. The territories they control are very slightly populated in that area. But they're worried about the presentation, the kind of reputation they get. And this is a big propaganda point for them, I think, more than anything else.
Well, I guess just finally then to ask, I guess, the same question from the opposite direction. To what extent are proclamations or declarations like the one they've issued on behalf of the Islamic Emirate, them taking advantage of this opportunity, if you like, to present themselves as the legitimate authority in this region?
Yeah, I think they are taking that opportunity. They always, whenever they can, they take that opportunity. They've never stopped calling themselves the legitimate government of the country. And this is just another opportunity for them to act like a government.
Rod Nordland there, Kabul bureau chief for The New York Times. Up next, where does James Bond get his gear?
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or the smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 on our robust new, upgraded, and free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back with wise words from The Big Interview, being briefed on the world of business with The Entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with The Sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here on Monocle 24. Another year, another James Bond film. Fans would likely say the series' longevity is down to the attitude, the locations, or the sheer wish fulfillment of it all. But a more realistic answer is that James Bond is an exceptional salesman. Product placement deals have long meant that producers could rely on a various car, technology, or alcohol company for a chunk of the film's budget. In return, audiences have had to endure lingering close-ups of mobile phones and clunking conversational dead ends about wristwatches. But with the new film Spectre, has James Bond finally learned how to sell subtly? On Tuesday's Monocle Daily, film critic Karen Krasanovich joined Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds to find out.
I'm a James Bond fan. I've seen every single one more than once, and I have seen, and really, is it any worse than some of, like, The Saint? You remember Val Kilmer looking at his, you know, Nokia phone?
I'm not sure I can name 10 things worse than The Saint off the top of my head.
Okay, well, at least you know the music was good. Product placement, or product integration, as it's now known.
Well, that's a thing by itself, isn't it, the change of the vocab?
Yes, is actually very important to keeping these kind of films alive. And in fact, a lot of smaller films would love to have this kind of integration to keep the budgets up, you know, sort of afloat. It takes a lot of money to put Bond on the road. Not only production costs, which is $300 million here, but double that for the promotional costs.
And what do we make of the change in this one? Because we alluded to that horrible conversation in Casino Royale where they talk about the wristwatch. It went, I mean, the end of the Brosnan era was a bit of a disaster. They called it By Another Day, didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, yes.
But the idea with Spectre is that it's a bit subtler. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I love the fact that, okay, a friend of mine was doing a lot of research on this, so I was like, sort of trying to help him. And they don't like to talk about this. You only get this kind of information through leaked emails, but they give you this impression that Daniel Craig's going, no, I will not use a Sony phone. It's not cool enough. Well, okay, so he missed out on, what, $5 million, something like that?
Personally.
But the point is that Bond is a very, very good brand, and it always was about the best, whether it was Dom Perignon or Omega or Aston Martin or whatever. It was always about that sort of thing. And, you know, those of us who lived in, you know, Shit Kicker Central. Oh, sorry. Can I say that?
Yeah, you can.
Sorry. Thank you. Calville Central thought, wow, we want to buy that. So it's very important, actually. But Bond is about excitement, and they don't take everything on board, although you did see the occasional mistakes throughout the Bond franchise, which was Kentucky Fried Chicken. Maybe that was a mistake.
Ouch.
Yep.
Hang on, he ate Seven Up. He ate Kentucky Fried Chicken.
No, he didn't, but it was actually featured. You kind of saw the shop.
Yeah, that's outside. Not a brand matchup,
no,
is it?
No, you didn't actually eat any.
Who in the relationship between the Bond franchise and the brands involved, who actually has the upper hand? Who needs who the most?
I would say it's probably pretty equal, depending on who it is. For example, Bond needs cars. He also needs guns, and he also needs a wristwatch. So these are the people that are going to have more of the arguing power, whether he's going to drink a Heineken or Dom Perignon or a Vesper cocktail is, I think, probably less important. I mean, we are talking 45, 50 million at least, sometimes more. So if you look at the budget, the promotional budget, this is actually a big chunk.
I mean, what I saw the film today and what I noticed is that, or rather what I didn't notice was lots of product placement in the film. But
no.
I did beforehand and in the weeks beforehand no. notice a lot of Daniel Craig's image associated with an unbelievable, with, and I would say associated much more deeply than we're used to. He's not just in a poster. He's in a specially filmed advert for it. So is there a way in which with this one, they've sort of siphoned off some of the advertising to outside the film itself to protect the integrity of the thing?
That's a very good point. Actually, there is a lot less product integration in the film, but exteriorly, if you go anywhere, you're going to find what, Belvedere, Kvodka. How many brands do you want me to mention? I mean, there's a lot.
Depends how much vodka you want.
We really should have got on the phone to a few of them while we were writing the script, shouldn't
sorry,
we?
Sorry, I should have done some planning. Die Another Day had 21 different brand associations. This one, they're saying, is only 7. But everywhere you go, you see Bondian advertisements, whether it's Heineken, Belvedere, Gillette, it's everywhere.
That was film critic Karen Krasanovich talking to Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds on the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. On Wednesday's The Globalist, our morning show here on Monocle 24, Peter Cardwell spoke to regular Monocle 24 contributor John Hemmings. The two focused on the simmering tension in the South China Sea, where the USS Lawson has recently entered waters 12 miles off the disputed Spratly Archipelago, where China has embarked on an island-building campaign of impressive scope, not that its neighbors share China's enthusiasm. China was outraged by the U.S. incursion, of course. The U.S., however, says China should calm down. Let's hear more about that from Peter and John.
I think a summoning of the U.S. ambassador is probably pro forma. We knew this was coming. The fact that the U.S. used a destroyer rather than a kind of lesser warship shows that this is a very big deal for the Americans. I mean, there's a lot at stake here. And what the Americans did was not, by any stretch of the imagination, gunboat diplomacy. It was carefully considered, debated heavily in Washington, the Obama administration, very reluctant to do it before the visit, even John Kerry pressuring not to do it before the Paris Climate Change Summit. So what's happened here has been a very carefully, very vetted exercise of freedom of navigation.
It's interesting you mention that, because this freedom of navigation idea really has come to the fore an awful lot through this sort of ongoing incident. But this was a really, as you say, a very deliberate act. What sort of conversations will the Americans have been having in terms of this? Because this is one of the busiest parts of the sea in the world, and these artificial islands created by the Chinese are very controversial.
In essence, imagine if you have a public highway and someone were to build basically a toll and to man it with weapons. Basically, it's a very geopolitical act what the Chinese have done. They've done something that's not supported by international law or even by their signatory to the UN Clause, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Seas.
Sorry to interrupt you, the Chinese, of course, you're talking about international law there. The Chinese, of course, have accused the United States of acting illegally.
Absolutely, absolutely. What the Americans have done essentially is when someone puts forward a legal understanding, it is incumbent, this is the understanding, that you have to challenge that understanding fairly soon afterwards, otherwise it becomes accepted as legitimate. So as we saw earlier last year, the Chinese established air identification zone over the East China Sea. Now, this has happened before, but the way the Chinese had done it was overlapping South Korea, Japan, and also countries were suddenly obliged to provide flight plans and to obey the commands of Chinese airspace. It was all very bit much, and so the Americans immediately flew in an unarmed aircraft just to say, no, we don't agree with this.
What about other countries in the region in this dispute more widely? It can't be fun for the United States, but it also can't be fun if you're Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, the Philippines, Taiwan. I mean, I've seen the Philippines have welcomed the US's actions, no friend of China's expansion themselves, of course.
It's interesting. I mean, aside from Cambodia, which is very close to Beijing, most states are beginning to align around the US position, because the US position, of course, the US is supporting its own interest. Three of its major allies, Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan, are all supplied a majority of their energy route through these trade routes. So having control of those trade routes is a huge psychological weapon for Beijing. But you are seeing countries that are not sure, should they bandwagon or with China? Should they go with a strong one? How serious are the Americans? So the Philippines and Vietnam, who have the most to lose, have pretty much thrown their lot in with the U.S. But you're seeing Malaysia and Indonesia, who have far less to lose, kind of holding the line a little bit, not sure which way to jump. There's about 50,000 ships each year go through those waters. So it's a significant trade route for China as well. But we're looking at something like 80 to 90% of Japanese and South Korean energy coming from the Middle East through those routes. So it's an immense psychological lever on U.S. allies to think about in the future, where should they be, you know, setting their allegiance. And of course, for China, it's a huge opportunity. There's undersea gas. 8% of all global fishing catch comes from those waters. And so they're building up these islands in a huge array, some of them looking like they might have anti-submarine capability. They have airports, all sorts of things, and they've promised non-military use.
Yeah. If you're in the United States, you're sort of taking that with a pinch of salt.
I think so.
Peter Cardwell there, talking to Monocle 24 contributor John Hemmings. You're listening to the recap on Monocle 24. Iceland is known for being almost entirely powered by renewable energy. Well, during a state visit to Reykjavik on Thursday, David Cameron said he was hoping to bring some of that positive energy back home, using the country's volcanoes to help power homes in the UK. Well, on Friday's The Globalist, Georgina Godwin was joined on the line by Dr. Dougal Jerram, lover of all things volcanic, and known by some as Dougal Earth, and others, Dr. Volcano. Let's hear what the good doctor had to say about the plan's plausibility.
It's really quite a fascinating idea that you can literally plug into Iceland's geothermal and hydroelectric systems. But, you know, we have been in the past connected to the United States via cable in the very early days of communication. So it's not so far-fetched.
Mm. How much would it cost and how long would it take?
Well, the cost, I think, needs to still be ironed out. But, it's, as you say, 10 years was indicated as a possibility. So that's the sort of time frame that we're looking at.
Mm. What would it mean for Britain in terms of cutting down on nuclear power plants?
Well, Iceland has not only geothermal power from its volcanoes, but it also is a vast source of hydroelectric power. It's a very wet island. There's lots of rivers and a combination of harnessing the volcanic energy and harnessing also the hydro energy provides a potentially quite reliable source of electricity. And they're looking at not only just connecting the UK, but also Norway and other parts of Europe.
Mm. Well, to tell us about the connecting, the actual nuts and bolts of it. As you say, that there has been a cable between across the Atlantic before, but this 750 miles seems an awfully long way.
Yes, well, as I say, it's less distance than the ones that went over the Atlantic. And technology has been connecting the oil plants and gas plants in the North Sea to the mainland for some considerable time. So, you know, the engineering, if you will, is potentially there. It's really just a case of do the economics work up?
That was Dr. Dougal Jerram talking to Georgina Godwin on Thursday's edition of The Globalist, right here on Monocle 24. We're nearly at the end of this week's edition of The Recap here on Monocle 24. But just time left to hear about an Italian political icon, notorious for nearly all the wrong reasons, bunga bunga parties included. Silvio Berlusconi is, of course, the subject of the new book, My Way, Berlusconi in His Own Words. And the book's author, Alan Friedman, joined Emma Nelson and Paul Osborne on Thursday's The Monocle Daily.
It was way back in March 20, 2014 that I first approached him. I didn't have very high expectations that he'd agree, but I had a challenge from my Italian publisher, Rizzoli. They said, can you get Berlusconi to spill the beans, tell his life story, and sign a release so that you own all the property in book form and movie form and everything, and you can, and he has no veto power over you? And I said, yeah, pigs can fly. But I went to see him, and we had a long talk. And the truth is, he eventually said, I trust you. And I said, really? And why is that? And he said, well, first of all, you're not Italian, because as we know in Italy, everybody either hates him or loves him. There's nothing in between. The idea of being an American who would go in there and be impartial is kind of shocking to the Italians. Anyway, he agreed. And for the past 18 months, I spent time with him at his villas in Milan and in Sardinia and all over the place, and we must have taped more than 100 hours of audio interviews. And I said, we're going to do this Frost-Nixon style, Silvio, meaning you're going to be Nixon, I'm going to be Frost, and we're going to video everything, and you're just going to have a no-holds-barred set of questions. So in that 18-month period, we went on overdrive, and I put every single question to him on every subject I could think of, and decided in the book to let him speak in his own words, because frankly, it doesn't need that much commentary when you hear what he has to say. You either believe it or you don't, but I leave it to the reader.
So 18 months, hundreds and hundreds of conversations, all videoed, as you say, modelled a little on the Frost-Nixon model. How much of it did you believe? How much of what he told you did you believe? How many times were you in the middle of listening to his fearsome denunciation of some scandal and you thought, oh, this isn't remotely credible?
Well, that, of course, happened on several occasions. But, you know, what was interesting about it is that I could tell, really, after a while I got to know him, and I could tell when I thought he was telling me something that was credible or not. So, you know, when we were talking about his friendship with George W. Bush or his international political activities, I didn't just take his word for it. I went out and investigated. I went to talk to White House officials. I went to talk to other former prime ministers. I even went to interview Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin, which was an interesting experience in itself.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. This show is produced by Tom Hall and edited by Nina Norick. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. But for now, for me, Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for listening, and goodbye.